and welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan, and I'm very excited to be sharing my interview with Paul Tremblay. Listeners have probably heard me talk about Paul here on the podcast, in particular his novel, A Head Full of Ghosts. Paul Tremblay has won the Bram Stoker, British Fantasy, and Massachusetts Book Awards, and is the author of The Cabin at the End of the World, Disappearance at Devil's Rock, A Head Full of Ghosts, the crime novels, The Little Sleep and No Sleep Till Wonderland, and the short story collection Growing Things and Other Stories. He's currently a member of the board of directors of the Shirley Jackson Awards, and his essays and short fiction have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Entertainment Weekly Online, and numerous Year's Best anthologies. He has a master's degree in mathematics and lives outside Boston with his family. I had the opportunity back in August to sit down remotely with Paul and talk about his most recent novel, Survivor Song, as well as his other books and the horror genre in general. Please enjoy. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so excited to finally have you on the podcast because I feel like I talk about at least Head Full of Ghosts, like every three episodes. Like it's constantly coming up because it's a running joke that among like my co-hosts and my coworkers that like nothing scares me, like they can't, nothing scares me. And it's like the one book that has scared me was The Exorcist. And so I read Head Full of Ghosts and I was like, oh, it's like The Exorcist, but like fun. And they were like, fun? And I was like, yeah.
I'll take that.
Right? So at the time of recording this, Survivor Song has been out for almost a month. What's it been like releasing a book in the time of COVID?
Oh, I mean, it's not ideal, obviously. You know, there's a lot of Zoom panels, you know, which are fun. I mean, in some ways you get, you know, to talk with people maybe you weren't going to be able to talk with because of travel. But, you know, obviously it's clearly more fun to go to bookstores. You know, I just realized recently, you know, partly just because I've been so like cloistered inside my own house, like I haven't even gone into a bookstore to see, like, if the book's out there. It's usually, you know, one of the first things I do is just to go see it in the bookstore. You know, it doesn't get old. It's fun to see your new book out there. Yeah, and I haven't really done that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this book in particular being about a pandemic has made it all a little bit more strange.
Yeah. Was it weird to like have the coronavirus starting to happen and you're like looking at your book like, uh-oh, I predicted a thing?
No, absolutely. I didn't handle it very well. Like one of my first interviews was in, I think it was late March, right? You know, right. I first went into quarantine the last 2 weeks of March.
Okay.
I did an interview that appeared online for Rolling Stone in the article. It's like, I'm very like apologetic and, you know, to the point where my editor called me like after the interview went live. She's like, you know, you shouldn't really be apologizing for the book. You know, I'm like, all right, you're right. I won't. Sorry. you know, and also, I mean, some of the things that sort of fit with what's going on today, especially on the medical side of it, was all because of the research that my sister helped me with. And she's a nurse at one of the biggest hospitals in Boston.
Gotcha.
So like when I was writing the book, I was like, oh, this is really cool. I got to like, you know, collaborate with my sister, you know, what a cool thing. Like, you know, she's one of my best friends. So that was, you know, a real joy. But now that, you know, she has had to go through the worst of it, you know, my anxiety and worries, you know, for everybody, but also for her, are sort of really wrapped up in everything as well. So yeah, it's all strange. I would prefer I would have preferred it not happen.
Yeah. Although I do think it definitely added a layer of terror to it, being like, oh God, this is, I mean, aside from the super rabies zombies, this is what's happening. Like, this is the reactions that are happening. The opening with the Facebook comments, I was simultaneously so angry and just laughing hysterically because I was like, I see this in everyday social media. Like, this is how people are reacting.
Yeah, no, I mean, that part I felt like wasn't difficult to predict. I don't know, like, I feel like with actually quite a few of my books, I've been sort of preoccupied with misinformation and just the glut of information that we receive and how it affects us. I think, like, Cabin at the End of the World, the book before this one, certainly sort of deals with that. You know, and this one too. So, I mean, if anything, I feel like I probably under or discounted how mainstream, like, you know, virus misinformation and how to, you know, best go about our daily lives during a pandemic, all that misinformation, how mainstream and politicized it's become.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the research you did for this one. Did you do any extensive research for any of your other books, or has this been sort of the most heavily researched?
Oh, I hate research.
I do too. That's why yeah. I asked.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's always like a pocket that I have to do. Like, I would say, yeah. I mean, certainly the medical part of it. And I was fortunate that I'd happened to listen to an audiobook about rabies like a few years before. I guess as one does. I don't know.
Yeah.
And so when I had the idea for the book, the central sort of trying to take like the zombie trope and make it, you know, ground it in as much reality as I could, I was like, oh, rabies is perfect.
Yeah.
So to speak. You know, so, but I went back to that book and, you know, there's a wealth of rabies information online too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, for, especially like the first 100 or so pages, that was definitely the challenge for me as a writer, because I'm just not used to trying to, you know, trying to synthesize the research into the story without being too info dumpy and whatnot.
Yeah, no, for
it
sure.
It was not my comfort level.
That's so legit. I, whenever I try to write something, I'm like, I'm just going to make up all new information because I don't want to do any research.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Do you have a favorite type of horror to write? Because I feel like all of your books, like there are threads that sort of, you know, I've noticed a trend of like parenthood or kids in your books, but in general, they seem, it seems to be different kind of tiers of horror in all of your books.
Tiers of horror. yeah, I mean, I mean, probably like playing with a supernatural ambiguous element is probably where I'm most comfortable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I try to make sure if I'm going to do that, it just can't be there for the sake of being there. That just can't be a gimmick. You know, it has to fit the theme of the story. So like, for example, with Survivor Song, you know, there's no ambiguity. You know, there's no supernatural elements. And I wasn't going to try to force it in there because that wasn't what the story called for.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And similarly, do you have a favorite type of horror to read?
I mean, I guess I'd go back to like, you know, who my favorite authors are. You know, I think especially when I first started reading horror, you know, besides Stephen King was my introduction, like most people.
Mm-hmm.
But like writers like Peter Straub and Shirley Jackson and Clive Barker. Mm-hmm. I think Clive Barker doesn't get enough credit for a lot of the writers today as being a huge influence. I'm both like super excited and a little wary that Books of Blood is going to be a series on Hulu in October.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah, so hopefully that's really good. But, you know, he was the first author that I read that I didn't feel safe with. Like, it was sort of like this weirdly exciting feeling like, oh my God, anything I could imagine or beyond my imagination could possibly happen.
Yeah.
In the Clive 80s stories. So I don't know. To me, I love that horror can be just so dispersed and so different. It can have like just a little piece of it, like quote unquote horror adjacent, or those are my favorite things. I'm more excited by reading something that, you know, seems new to me. That doesn't mean it has to be written now. It could be something new that, you know, it could be even a reread that I rediscover something. You know, when we first went into quarantine, I sort of broke out of my laying on the couch watching Mythbusters and Animal Planet cycle by rereading Peter Straub's The Throat.
Nice.
Sort of strange that was like comforting because it's not a comforting novel. But, you know, just what he does, like, you know, on a sentence level, but also on a story level, just, you know, helped me get back a piece of myself.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely... I'm always like looking for new horror to ingest because again, like it takes so much. I'm so desensitized to everything that when I find something that I'm like, that was creepy. I'm like, oh yay.
Yeah, I mean, reading, that's usually my response too. I mean, it's clearly less visceral than a movie, but I find like, you know, so I've been recommending a lot, like a more recent book that I just love. I think it's the best story collection of the 21st century. is Mariana Enriquez's Things We Lost in the Fire.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. And every story is like so different. You know, sort of like quiet, like Shirley Jackson style story, the ghost story, but then she goes like full Lovecraftian. the opening story is just so brutal and so disturbing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just so, like, you know, beautifully written. It's the kind of thing, like, in the moment, I'm, like, excited, but it, you know, lingers with me. And, you know, I'll wake up at 2:30 a.m. and that's when I'll be creeped out by it.
Yes. Yeah, that's the perfect when it, like, it sticks with you and you don't even realize it stuck with you. And you're just like...
Right.
That happened when I read The Return by Rachel Harrison. I was like, I read it and I was like, oh, that was really good. And then like I finished it and I put it down and I was just sitting there like staring into the corners of my room like, oh, that was creepier than I thought it was. which I love. So you mentioned some of your top horror influences, but I'm curious how you got into writing horror because don't you have a degree in math?
I do, yeah.
Cool. what was that journey like?
Well, I don't know. Like, I graduated from high school in 89. I don't know. And so, you know, the college pressure thing really wasn't like it is now. Because, you know, I teach high school math still. You know, and all the preparation that so many of these kids put into it. I mean, honestly, I was like, I don't know. Like, I applied to a few schools. It's like, I kind of like their basketball team. Yeah, I guess I'll go there. Nice. And I just started off as a math major because that was what I was best at school. Nice. And just sort of fumbled along, you know, to the point where when I applied to UVM for grad school for math, I didn't hear from them. Never got a rejection letter or acceptance. And that's like the summer after graduating college rolls around. Yeah, I've got no job. Nothing's going on. Parents getting divorced. Like things are like just weird everywhere. It's like a month before the semester is supposed to start. And I get a call from UVM, the dean. He's like, hey, we were moving my office and we found your application under my desk. Would you like to be considered? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, so he called me back like a week later. He's like, hey, you're in and, you know, we'll offer you a fellowship, which meant like tuition free. And I would teach a class while I was there. So like, all right, see you in 3 weeks. Awesome. You know, so when I say I literally like fumbled into getting a master's in math. I pretty much did. But while I was at the University of Vermont, right before I left, my girlfriend, who's my wife, Lisa now, gave me Stephen King's A Stand for my birthday.
Nice.
So that coupled with reading a Joyce Carol Oates story called Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been? Really just sort of turned me into a reader.
Wow.
Yeah. So while I was at Vermont doing the long distance relationship thing, so I was mostly in my room, you know, I just read all the King and then Straub and Shirley Jackson. And when I came out of grad school, I just had this weird, you know, I got my teaching job and I had this weird itch to try writing a story. So yeah, I didn't really start until later, I think, compared to most writers.
That's awesome.
It was sort of an inexplicable itch. Like, I don't know why I thought I could write a story. It's just, I don't know. Like, I think most people, it's like you mimic something. Like, when you get older, you figure out, you know, it's okay to be passionate about something. And usually that passion makes you want to try it. You know, same thing with music. Like, I love, you know, punk music and you know, some metal too. So, like, you know, I tried playing guitar too, but, you know, I figured out I was a better writer than a musician. So. That's the one that stuck.
That's awesome. And now you have like blurbs from Stephen King on your books. Oh, like, that's crazy. Cool.
Yeah.
I was looking at your website and I was like, oh my God, like that must be so just bizarre to have Stephen King be like, oh, this book terrified me. Like, what?
No, absolutely. I mean, his response to Head Full of Ghosts remains like a top three moment for me in my writing career for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. Man, oh God, I love that book so much. What's the scariest book you've ever read?
Oh, scariest.
If there is one.
Man, it's hard to, it's fine. I can always think of scariest movies, you know, based on nightmares, but like, you know, scariest book is tough for me.
It's hard, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some of Laird Barron stuff. Like he wrote a short story called The Broadsword.
Okay.
That was one of the few times I feel like I had a visceral reaction to the story while reading it.
Nice.
You know, and if I were to describe like why, I mean, it was sort of like this disembodied voice that speaks at a really critical point in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And now I goosebumps, shivers, the whole thing. I was totally freaked out.
Awesome.
Similarly with a Stephen Graham Jones short story called Raphael.
Mm.
You know, it sort of just goes along and then there's this holy crap moment in the middle of it that, you know, that scene is forever stuck in my head. So odd that, you know, I go right away to two, you know, two short stories, I suppose, but.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm again, constantly looking for new things because I feel like people are always recommending very sort of like mainstream, like, ah, read Stephen King, like read Shirley Jackson. I'm like, no, I have. I'm like, you don't understand. It takes so much.
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned, Mariana Enriquez. Yeah. That first story, I would defy anyone to be not sort of affected by that first story. Awesome. In the collection. Also, Nathan Ballingrud, I don't know if you had a chance to read him.
No, I haven't.
He has two short story collections, one called North American Lake Monsters, which Hulu is making into a show for October.
Oh, wow.
Called Monsterland, I believe is what it's going to be called.
Okay.
Sort of loosely based on some of the stories, but his most recent collection called Wounds, which was a movie, is based on the novella Visible Filth. And that is a creepy, creepy novella.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. Why do you think, because I feel like, I don't know if I would call it maybe a resurgence of horror, but I feel like in recent years, I'm just seeing more and more horror being sort of mainstream. And like, why do you think the horror genre resonates with people so well?
Geez, I don't know. I mean, there's sort of like the old saw. Well, I don't know if it's an old saw for everybody, but usually in horror, people say, oh, during times of like, you know, economic or social strife, you know, horror tends to be popular. Like, you know, they look back to the Reagan 80s where horror had its boom.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of now, you know, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. Not that I know what the answer is, you know, because, you know, these aren't the same times.
Right.
I think, though, that you're just seeing a lot of work made by people who consumed all that stuff in the 80s, you know, whether like as teens or, you know, might be a little bit younger, but still, you know, went back to see all that. I do think the genre stigma is not as strong as it used to be. I mean, it's certainly still there. And honestly, I think, you know, it's, you know, Harry Potter readers when they were kids, they, you know, no one told them that, oh, you shouldn't be reading that.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Horror stuff. So they became adults, you know, they're not afraid to dip into genre too. Yeah. So I don't know. You know, movies, I think obviously sort of lead the way too, even though, you know, most mainstream Hollywood productions aren't great. I think, you know, there's just so many really good independent, you know, horror movies out there.
Yeah.
You know, that have had a huge impact, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I would agree with that. One of the main characters in Survivor Song is like, what, 38 weeks pregnant, right, dealing with this crazy zombie plague, basically. Super rabies pandemic. And I read it at 36 weeks pregnant, which I don't know if that was a smart decision. although I do have to say, very like spot on, accurate pregnancy symptoms.
Oh,
but sort of, did you know going into it that one of the characters was like that going to be the thing? Was that one of the characters was going to have to maybe deliver a baby while maybe turning into a zombie?
Yeah, that was. I'm pretty much sort of like the sort of starting point / what if.
Yeah.
That the story sort of grew around. Yeah, but you know, I was definitely cognizant. I didn't want it to be like you know, sort of the science fiction horror trope of, you know, oh, it's, you know, we must save the pregnant woman, you know, to repopulate the species kind of thing.
Right.
You know, which I actually have the characters talk about a little bit.
Yeah.
In the novel at one point. Yeah, I don't know. I was definitely, you know, so you're referencing the character Natalie.
Yes.
And I'm not in her point of view very often, with the exception of the prelude at the very beginning, and then she leaves messages for her unborn child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I didn't want to spend, you know, 300 pages writing about what it felt like to be an 8.5 month. I didn't think that was probably, I certainly don't have that perspective to tell that story. So most of the story is told from her best friend Romola's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which I felt a lot more comfortable doing.
it was great. And once I, like, because she gets bitten right away,
right
at the beginning, and I was like, oh. Once I realized, like, oh, this is different, like, this isn't, again, like you said, like, save the pregnant woman at all costs, it was like, oh, this is gonna be fun. It's like the race against the clock, and
that was one of the appeals. Like, we've read so many, like, you know, zombie or pandemic novels where it's cast of thousands, And it sort of details, like, lovingly details or fetishizes, like, everything falling apart. And I wanted to go in the opposite direction for both. So, I mean, with the exception of a couple other characters, it's really Romola and Natalie. It's essentially told in real time, like, over 4 to 6 hours.
Yeah.
So the hope is, like, maybe as long as it takes you to read it, that's sort of how long, you know, the story goes for those two characters. And I mean, Natalie herself, like, she's like, no, I made my husband promise, you know, you save me over the kid. You know, I always appreciate, you know, being a parent, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, so many of my stories and my previous novels dealt with parents and families. I don't know, I always appreciate it when movies or books are really honest about some of the darker panic thoughts you have as a parent. So I think the movie, The Babadook, is just so brilliant. It's just one of the most honest portrayals of parenthood or motherhood that I've ever seen. Like, just sort of those, you know, those dark thoughts that you have, like, and you're not a bad person for having them. It's just a natural reaction to the daily WTF of trying to raise a kid. You know, in this world.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I have found that if there is sort of one thread that does creep me out in horror novels, it is when there's, like, a parent-child dynamic and, like, something is going on, like, with the kids or whatever. Like, when I read The Need by Helen Phillips, and it opens with her protecting her kids, her two kids, one of whom is kind of too young to understand, be quiet, because she thinks there's someone in the house, and there is.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? This is terrifying. This is great. Which is funny as a mom to be like, I like to read things, but, you know, it's, I like scary things. And that's one of the few things that actually kind of ticks that box. Is when there is that, because you're right, like, there are those, like, dark thoughts and things like that, and it's like, it doesn't make you a bad person, but it does tap into something. There's this sort of,
sure, I think it also ramps into the feelings of not being in control when you know, you are sort of socially conditioned to think as the parent you are in control, like, it's sort of the lie. You know, I don't even think it's necessarily a purposeful lie, but you're the parent, you're in control of your kid, and you quickly find out, well, you're not in control.
Yeah.
Necessarily of what they do. You're certainly not in control of what's happening around them. And it's, you know, even more, you know, you just realize being a parent is just this, like, at times, just really powerless feeling, as beautiful as the experience is.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that weird sort of bipolar life of a parent, I guess.
Yeah, totally. As I was putting my daughter to bed last night, I, like, caught a glimpse of her closet out of the corner of my eye. And I was like, did I just see something in her closet? You know, I'm not gonna check. I'm not gonna be that person.
Yeah, she can handle it.
I was like, I'm not gonna die this early in the horror movie. Nope. Yeah. Awesome. So, all right. So what's next for you? Do you have anything in the pipeline? Are you just kind of hanging out? Or are you working on anything?
William Morrow, my publisher, is going to re-release my first two novels, which are crime novels.
Oh, awesome.
They were published in 2009 and 2010. Yeah, and they're sort of, like, weird. They're sort of dark, maybe hopefully darkly humorous crime novels. They're called A Little Sleep and No Sleep to Wonderland. And they feature a narcoleptic private detective in South Boston.
Awesome.
So it was weird that was, like, my first novels published, because I spent pretty much my whole writing life to that point writing horror short stories. I just happened to have an idea for this weird detective. So then I was being introduced as Paul Tremblay, crime writer. I'm like, oh, who's that? and they didn't sell very well, and things were a mess with the original publisher. So, I'm happy that they'll be put back out into the world. And they're supposed to be coming out Little Sleep, January 2021.
Okay.
And then 3 months later, the second one in April.
Fantastic.
So I also did just sign a new deal with Morrow, so I'm writing a novel right now called The Pallbearers Club.
Okay.
Which, you know, if all things go, which is always a dangerous thing, according to plan, would be out sometime in, like, 2022 or something like that.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's more back to horror. Although this one is definitely going to be a lot different than the last two novels in particular, Survivor Song and Cabins, because both of those I feel like are, you know, tight timeline and, you know, pretty hopefully suspenseful, quickly moving. And this Pallbearers Club novel is being presented as a faux memoir. So it's a little bit more meandering and digs into the character a little bit before it gets into the weirdness. Well, who knows? Like I say that.
And could be totally different. You could write a whole different book by then. That sounds awesome though. That sounds really great.
Thanks.
Cool. Okay. I think that's all I have for you today.
Right.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks again to Paul Tremblay for being so generous with his time and chatting with me. Survivor Song is on our shelves now, along with the rest of his books, so do be sure to purchase those if you're craving something spooky to read this month. A reminder about our partnership with Libro FM. Our listeners who are new to Libro FM can receive 3 digital audiobooks for the price of 1 credit by using the code LAYDOWN at checkout when they start a new membership. It's a fantastic deal that you should absolutely take advantage of. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books that were mentioned during today's episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks. Bye!